This is a podcast from the Abbey at St. David's Episcopal Church.
Okay. Hello, and welcome to our third Reflective Spaces podcast. I'm Joyce Palovitz, and I'm here with Gustavo Hernandez and Linda Young Caffey. Hello, Gus and Linda.
Hi.
Hi, Joyce. Great to be back.
Great to be back together. Our hope is that these podcasts provide an opportunity for all of us to sit quietly and explore what emerges from the images and ideas we experience together. As we have before on this podcast, we will begin with a short poem. And we invite you to sit with us as we sit and listen to it and explore its wisdom. Today's poem has been selected by Gustavo. And it is a Thomas Burton poem, which we'll now ask Gustavo to introduce and read to us. So, Gustavo, over to you.
Thank you, Joyce. I appreciate it. And today I'm going to read When in the Soul of the Serene Disciple by Thomas Burton. And I do want to say something, which is, before I start, is that the language here is definitely very male-centric, right? And it was difficult to change it to be more gender neutral. So it's something that we'll talk about it probably, you know, as we start discussing the poem. So here it goes. When in the Soul of the Serene Disciple by Thomas Merton. When in the soul of the serene disciple with no more fathers to imitate, poverty is a success. It is a small thing to say the roof is gone. He has not even a house. Stars, as well as friends, are angry with the noble ruin. Saints depart in several directions. Be still. There is no longer any need of comment. It was a lucky wind that blew away his halo with his cares. A lucky sea that drowned his reputation. Here you will find neither a proverb nor a memorandum. There are no ways, no methods to admire where poverty is no achievement. His God lives in his emptiness like an affliction. What choice remains? Well, to be ordinary is not a choice. It is the usual freedom of men without visions.
So, Gustavo, this is a hard poem, isn't it? And I think we're probably curious about what made you select this.
This is a poem that was first introduced when I was reading Richard Rohr's Falling Upwards. It was the first time I ran into it. And he used it as a way to talk about the first and second half of life. But in general, I just find it a very difficult poem. It's a mystery. It's like a cone that keeps revealing itself, and it's uncomfortable to read, because to me at least, it feels like it's talking about dissolving this idea of who we are, you know, this halo that we carry with us, you know, this reputation that we needed to walk in this world, you know, to be effective in being professionals and have a professional life, you know, and get another job and get a promotion and be invited to be in the podcast, right? I mean, these are the things that you carry, so this is who I think you are. Yet, you know, once we believe it, we are infinitely less than who we really are, right? And so for me, who I'm in the middle of my career and life and trying to be a parent, all of that, it's a difficult poem, right? It's a reminder to see beyond these things that we think we are, because sometimes, you know, it's better not to believe it completely, right? So it's good to have, I think it was actually Rohr that says, you should pray for a small humiliation every day, just to keep it real. So anyway, so that's what I like it. I think it's a poem that is, I don't read it all the time, but every once in a while it comes back and it's I feel like it's a healthy reminder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes me think of a Hafiz poem that's from I Heard God Laughing that says, God is amused that you once tried to be a saint.
So Linda, how does the poem strike you?
I think there's a lot in it that it reminds me of a class I took at seminary on leadership. And one of the things he was using examples like Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, Oscar Romero. And the discussion was about the ego and that in order to lead, you have to have enough ego to step forward and that you have to be aware that that's what you're doing so that you allow room for other people to participate as well as for you to listen to what you're being called to do so your ego doesn't take over. And it's a tricky job because it's hard for the ego not to take over. So this says to me a lot about being very mindful of that. Like Gus says, it's part of being in the world. And yet, you know, I heard somebody describe the ego once as like the ego gets you dressed and us sitting here on Zoom talking. That we need that part, but if it takes over, then that's when the problems begin. Mm-hmm. And so the little humiliations that Gus is referring to is, which I don't have to seek out, they just happen. But they remind you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they remind you that you're not. And so what's coming to mind for me is this carrying this idea of I am a beloved child of God and that preciousness and that, and yet at the same time, understanding that maybe so is everybody else. And so there's mm-hmm. nothing about me that's particularly extraordinary in that way. And that, so it's like I get the halo because I'm this beautiful child of God, but I can't get wrapped up in the fact that I have this halo because everybody else has it. So if everybody else has it, then the halo is not, it's not distinguishing anymore.
Yeah, I love that analogy, Joyce. I think that's wonderful, right? That, well, you know, it brings this idea of gifts, right? And spiritual gifts and that we all have these gifts that we bring, you know, to this world. And part of the journey is to discover those gifts, you know, but we all have a different gift, right? And maybe that is also another way to look at the halo, that to get too caught up in that we all serve a role and maybe to think that we are more beloved than anybody else, then is that's taking you in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm.
Just as the opposite, it can be problematic if you don't think enough, if you're too self-critical mm-hmm. or not think enough of yourself, then you can block what you're here to do.
True.
It is what you said. It's a paradox.
Mm-hmm. So I was curious. There is a line here, which is, to me, it's the most difficult line that says, his God lives in his emptiness like an affliction.
How do you read that?
I'm not sure.
One of the challenges for me in this is it feels a little bit like self-flagellating a little bit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like, well, you have to have an affliction. I understand about difficult experiences bring us to opening, to possibility and opening to surrendering, that sort of thing. But an affliction sounds a little harsh.
I agree. That's why I struggle with that line, right? It doesn't sound like a good place to be.
Right? That's an understatement. Do you have a take on it, Joyce?
I'm quiet because the first thought, as you guys were talking about that came to mind, is that knowing what I know about Merton is, I don't think he would mean for people to take this as self-flagellation. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think he lived his life that way, my understanding of it. And so there must be something else there. It causes me to say, okay, what else is there? How do I process this? How do I think about this? How is God ever an affliction? Mm. I mean, if I just say his God lives in his emptiness, in my God lives in my emptiness like an affliction. And I'm wondering if part of what he might mean there is when you strip away everything. Mm-hmm. Back at the beginning, it says poverty, when poverty is a success. So what is poverty? I have nothing. Mm-hmm. When I strip away everything and the only thing that's there is God, it can feel like an affliction because I have stripped away everything else that I thought was important.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
Maybe.
I don't know. It's one of the things that makes this a very tough poem.
Yeah.
I guess I don't, and maybe I haven't had the experience that Merton had, but I guess I think find the emptiness to be a positive and very healing. So the affliction is kind of confusing.
So Linda, for you, emptiness is a positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't feel like an affliction.
No, it's making space for more than me, for something uh-huh. much bigger than me. And I have to get out of the way to do that. Now, I don't know if it equates with the kind of stripping down that you're talking about or what Merton did, but.
Yeah, I think, And that's a good point, Joyce, about, you know, knowing who Merton was. You know, and one thing that I kind of relate to Merton is that he was seeking solitude. He wanted to be a hermit, but he also wanted to connect with people constantly, right? Mm-hmm. And he was such a prolific writer, and he wrote to so many people, and he craved the human connection, and at the same time, he wanted to be, you know, a hermit, and he wanted to be by himself and in contemplation and all of that. And maybe this is speaking about that struggle,
mm.
right? Yeah. About that tension that, you know, that about this desire to seek, you know, shedding ourselves of all this stuff, right? This reputation thing, this halo, these material things, but also having this deep desire for connection and for liking the things in life, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I wonder if that's what he was talking about there. Yeah.
So it's sort of personal, and it's the poem has a personal aspect to it. Because if I remember correctly, this came from Seven Story Mountain, which is autobiographical.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we'll fact check that.
I'm not Googling at the moment.
Yeah.
The part that I have a question, and maybe it ties in with it, I don't know, but it's the last part, and it's a little confusing for me, that very last verse. Well, to be ordinary is not a choice. It is the usual freedom of men without visions. And it seems like it contradicts itself, because we were talking about being ordinary and unique at the same time, that paradox.
Mm.
But then of men without visions, I keep reading it, and maybe you all have a different take on it.
Yeah, actually, I see this is the liberating part. This is when you're free, right? Because it said, what choice remains? There's no other choice, right? To be ordinary is not a choice. It's just, it's to be free, to have the freedom of men without visions. And, you know, as somebody who, as part of my professional life, people are looking for answers from me, right? And they're constantly, there is this demand of performing and setting direction. It is such a liberating idea to walk through this world without having a vision, just being there.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And actually, that to me is actually kind of the punchline, you know, and that's, I think, I, you know, kind of refreshes the difficult aspect of the poem, is that to be free is to walk this world without a vision. I don't know. I like it. I find it like a breath of fresh air, right?
I could
use a day when, you know, yes, you know, I'm just gonna be, right? Just to be an spectator, just to walk, and essentially going back to the point, like, you know, being a Mary Oliver poem, just to feel the grass and just appreciate nature, right? Yeah. You know, you're just there taking it all in.
You know, I just wonder if what you were bringing up about the way he wrote with about gender, but also he's writing from a masculine or male standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it really did take you explaining that, your perspective on that, for me to get it, because the vision is part of the journey from my standpoint. Mm-hmm. So I just wonder if maybe some of the reason that it was a challenge for me to understand it is it comes from more of a masculine perspective. Maybe not, but I just wonder, because I kept reading it and go, why am I having so much trouble with this?
Yeah. Absolutely. I can see that. Yeah. I can see that.
But I understand what you were saying. I mean, that provided a lot of clarity, what you were saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could probably talk another half hour on this poem, couldn't we?
It seems like it.
So much here. And I'm thinking that this might be a good place for us to stop and just let the people who are listening to this podcast think of their own reactions to it, and perhaps even send some comments. Maybe we can crowdsource meaning from this poem.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Gustavo, thank you for selecting this. I know it caused the three of us to think a lot, and that's good. That we need to challenge ourselves sometimes, I think, to do this. Any last minute thoughts, Linda, from you, or Gus from you?
I just want to say thank you. This has been a very good discussion. You know, I really enjoy it, and just again, I think it's a poem that brings a lot of emotions and a lot of feelings and perspective, and I think that's what made this conversation so good, so interesting. So thank you.
And I think too, it's interesting to consider this in 2021 when it was written in the 60s.
Yeah.
Because there's some universality and there's some things that have to do with the time also.
Yeah.
So we're balancing both.
Yeah.
But yeah, thanks for the challenge, Jess.
And so we'll put a link to this poem up on the Abby website so that people who want to actually read it and chew on it a little bit can do that. And so we want to thank everybody for sitting with us and reflecting with us. And we hope this has brought some insights for you. And we'll just sign off until next time. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Joyce. Thanks, Beth.
Bye.
For more information about the Abbey, podcasts, resources, or groups to join on Zoom, visit theabbey.us.